I'd like now to welcome Sally Seidel. She is a professor of physics at the University of New Mexico, and tomorrow night, Wednesday, she will be speaking from 6 to 7:30, leading a discussion called Discovering New Particles at the O'Keefe Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue here in Santa Fe, sponsored by the Santa Fe Alliance for Science. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So when we talk about discovering new particles, is anything new automatically smaller and a subset of what we've already discovered?
The most famous discovery recently of a new particle is the Higgs boson, which was announced by international collaborations of thousands of people on the 4th of July in 2012. And that is not a subset of any other particle. In fact, it has this amazing ability to unify the properties of all of the particles that we know that have mass. It's not a constituent of any other particle.
And so what is it?
We think of the Higgs boson as being a ripple in a field that fills all of space. Think of space as being filled by some sort of entity which, as a particle or anything larger than a particle, including a person, moves through it, produces drag on that person or on that particle, makes them feel more massive because it's hard to move through this field. And that's how the field gives them their mass, and ripples in that field are the Higgs boson.
Now, when we make analogies like ripples, the kind of physics you're talking about is not analogous to the kind of physics that we intuitively know. And so for us to try to understand what that ripple means, is it possible to make a kind of analogy, a macro scale analogy that we can understand?
Well, I think that that's what I was trying to do, in the sense of including people as recipients of the effect of the Higgs field. So a person trying to wade through a swimming pool feels it's harder to move than wading through the air. Think of the water in the swimming pool as being the Higgs field, which is dragging on your body, making you feel more massive. That's how we think of the Higgs field.
So it's a field, and it's also a particle?
That's right, yes. That's one of the insights of 20th century physics, is that everything is a particle and a field at the same time.
Tell us a little bit about the process that you have to use to understand these kinds of particles. I mean, they're infinitesimally small and certainly invisible, but you need very large installations in order to study them.
That's true. The smaller something is, the more energy we need to probe its characteristics. So the particular experiment that I work on right now with 2,999 collaborators is located at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland. It's called the ATLAS experiment. It's one of four similarly sized experiments at that laboratory. And these experiments are so large that they would easily fill a basketball court or a small stadium. And they're so specialized that everything in the experiment is custom built for its unique purpose. That's why it requires 3,000 people to contribute, to develop, and then to analyze the results of these measurements.
It's such an interesting kind of collaboration because everybody is highly specialized and highly trained, and I think there's nobody who understands every facet of what it takes to make that stadium-sized collaboration or mm-hmm. installation work.
It is it's actually a very beautiful coming together of people from all over the planet bringing things to the experiment that are their unique expertise and specialization, and coming together in a way that is largely non-hierarchical, involves receptivity to all kinds of skills and interests, and doesn't have a CEO. it's right. Something that people do because they love to do it, and My particular experiment involves over 70 institutes from over 30 nations, drawn from every continent except Antarctica.
Now, what is your specific role?
So I lead the Collider Physics Group at the University of New Mexico Department of Physics. We have been involved in developing some of the detectors that are at the very core, the very heart of this gigantic, you know, basketball court-sized detector. We develop silicon devices that can track the particles to distances of microns, and those are intrinsic to discovering the very rarest particles that are produced at the heart of the collision. And having contributed those to the hardware of the experiment, we then analyze the data, and we have studied quarks, mesons. We have, in 2014, announced the discovery of a new particle ourselves, not the Higgs, but a different particle called the B-C2S.
So this huge discovery made on the 4th of July, 2012, what does it tell us about the nature of the universe? What do we still not know? What further experiments need to be done and are being done?
So what the discovery of the Higgs boson told us is that we understand something about how fundamental particles acquire their mass. What we still don't understand are some of the obvious puzzles that have emerged during the 20th and 21st century. For example, dark matter. We have no idea what the dark matter is. I'll mention that in my talk. We don't understand why there are some particles that have very tiny masses, some that have very large masses. We think that there might be other sectors of nature that have never been probed yet that might explain the striking differences among different types of fundamental particles. One of the theories that might address that is called supersymmetry, and I'll mention that in my talk as well.
Supersymmetry. Give us a hint what that is.
It's the idea that maybe every type of particle that we do know about has a partner called its supersymmetric partner, and working together, those particles accomplish a number of unifications in nature, one of which is to bring the couplings or the strengths or the fundamental forces together to be the same at the dawn of the universe.
We're talking to physicist Sally Seidel. I find myself admiring what you guys are doing and seeing the joy and somehow sensing that there's some importance to this, but because I'm not a physicist and can only in the vaguest terms understand what you're doing, and that's true of probably most of the people listening to the program today, what would you, as a physicist, like us out here in radio land, to know about your work? Like, how is it important for ordinary people, if it is?
What physicists like myself do, we're particle physicists, we study the most fundamental elements of nature, the basic forces and the basic constituents, and all of the more complicated structures in the universe are built out of them. So in order to build better technology, to invent new electronics, to build more robust mechanical structures, we need to understand the basic forces and particles that they use. We're often surprised ourselves by the spin-offs that come from our work. I think everyone in the world now has heard that CERN, where our experiment is located, is where the World Wide Web was born. When Einstein discovered general relativity, no one in the world would have imagined that it would be essential to make GPS systems work.
Right. And so what you're doing, I mean, it's such a great example of quote-unquote pure science, where it's not about solving a problem for a practical application. Nobody knows what the application is. It might not have one, or it might have one two generations from now.
Exactly. It opens new windows. It makes things possible.
Now, what is the role of New Mexico in this big picture of particle physics of the kind that you're doing?
The national laboratories, and especially Sandia and Los Alamos, have been particularly involved in the work that my group at UNM does. There's a lot of expertise, specialized facilities, and collaborators at those laboratories who are able to contribute to development of radiation-resistant materials. The collisions at the Large Hadron Collider produce enormous amounts of radiation, which is well shielded so that it doesn't harm any people who participate in the experiment. But the detectors themselves are exposed to enormous doses and have to be able to withstand it and continue to operate and produce good data. And we at the University of New Mexico work at Los Alamos and at Sandia with scientists, physicists, and engineers there in developing new radiation-resistant technologies.
Which is interesting because there's any number of applications for that, including, I would imagine, going into space.
Space, medicine, there are many uses for these technologies, yes.
You gave a talk which is on, I think, the UNM website, and one of the things that you brought up was this question of matter and antimatter. In theory, there should be the same amount of matter and antimatter in the universe. In reality, it's pretty hard to find antimatter. First of all, what is antimatter, and where did it all go?
Well, that's a very good question. Where did it all go? And that's one of the fundamental questions that we're interested in. We understand that for every type of particle we know, there is a partner called its antiparticle, which has almost all of the same properties, but in particular, it has the opposite charge. So that if a particle and the same type of antiparticle meet, they will annihilate and produce pure energy. We believe that this should lead to equal amounts of matter and antimatter having been produced at the time of the Big Bang. And when we reproduce little miniature Big Bangs at colliders, like the Large Hadron Collider, we do in fact see equal amounts of matter and antimatter emerging. And our fundamental theory, quantum field theory, tells us that we should have equal amounts of matter and antimatter resulting from any interaction. So, indeed, where did it all go? We're all matter. And one of the things that my research group is interested in is exploring whether the evident absence of the antimatter is related to properties of the heaviest quarks. One of the things that we study are the so-called bottom and charm quarks, which may give us hints about the antimatter.
So in antimatter, you've got positively charged electrons, negatively charged protons, and neutrons are the same?
Well, the neutrons would be different in a different way. The antiparticles are similar, but not identical to the particles in some of their fundamental properties, some of their quantum numbers.
How do you study antimatter?
It's studied in the same way as matter. It can be produced in a collider like the Large Hadron Collider, and it can be captured with magnetic fields and made to rotate in a large circular track and brought into collision with matter, brought into collision with the target. In fact, a predecessor experiment to the ones that are taking place at the Large Hadron Collider used antiprotons instead of protons in one of the beams.
We're talking to physicist Sally Seidel. So what is your lab like at UNM? What is your life like and that of your students and collaborators?
So at UNM, our group includes between 8 and 10 people at any given time. This work definitely cannot be done by an individual. There are UNM undergraduates and graduate students, as well as professional engineer, technical people, people with very specialized expertise, postdoctoral fellow, and everyone in some sense works together. Sometimes people are specializing in the hardware and the development of new technologies. Sometimes people are specializing in analyzing the Large Hadron Collider data. We meet informally almost every day and formally once a week where we present to each other on our results and ask each other questions. Those meetings typically do not involve all of us being in the same room. Some people are stationed at CERN, 8 time zones away. Sometimes people are traveling on special assignment for various parts of their work. So often we are speaking to people all over the globe at the same time.
English being the common language.
English being the common language in our group, but there are certainly collaborators on the experiment who don't need to use English for their meetings if no one is a native English speaker in the collaboration.
How did you get into this field? Was it something that drew you very early when you were a kid?
When I was a kid, I was reading astronomy books, and after a while realized that what appealed to me most about the astronomy were the issues that overlapped with particle physics. And then I had a fairly normal attraction to it in high school and then in college. And I went to graduate school. When I got to graduate school, I wasn't immediately sure what kind of physics I wanted to study, but within a year, I identified particle physics. And actually, at that time, wasn't working at an accelerator or a collider, but was working in an experiment that was located deep underground in a mine.
Now, you will be speaking with the young people, students and adults, whoever wants to come to the presentation for the Santa Fe Alliance for Science. Is there a visual component to your presentation? Is this something that you can demonstrate or present visually?
I will be showing slides. They show pictures and images that I hope will improve the clarity of what I say. I don't have a demo or anything that I can carry in my hands.
Sally Seidel is a professor of physics at the University of New Mexico, and once again, tomorrow night, Wednesday the 25th of February from 6 to 7:30, she will be leading a student discussion called Discovering New Particles at the O'Keefe Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue. It's sponsored by the Santa Fe Alliance for Science, and it's for both students and young people. Admission is free. Everybody is welcome. There will be refreshments. We will see you there. Sally, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.